You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here. We're broadcasting today from the Wisconsin State Fair. What a beautiful day. It's UW-Madison Day. So the University of Wisconsin-Madison faculty and staff are here in force. And believe me, we have got plenty for you to see if you come out to the fair. I hope you'll come out. If you have some time today, stop by. We got somebody just handing me some cheese right now. You can have some cheese. You can have ice cream. You can make some DNA. You can take a look at a survey that's going on of the health of Wisconsin. There's a pretty cool show on the road with that. We'll be talking about that on another day. But it's a great day to be at the Wisconsin State Fair and a great day to have Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. It's the first Wednesday of the month. Scott is... always here on the first Wednesday, aren't you, Scott?
Yes, and this worked out very well to have it coincide with State Fair. It's great to be here this morning.
You know, and we're in a great location. If you're looking for us, to my right, we have the Cream Puff building, and to my left is the beer. So we're kind of, typical Wisconsin, a great place to go. And before we get started, Scott, your friends and colleagues at the Wildlife Ecology Department wanted me to remind you of a birthday that you have coming up.
Really?
This next week.
I have no comment on the matter.
I'm told that Scott Craven is going to be 60 years old. Can you believe that?
That is correct.
Let's give Scott a hand here. Hey, happy birthday, Scott. All right. And his advanced age has not affected his mind at all, and he's here to answer your questions. So if you'd like to join in, have a question for Scott, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And for our audience members, if you have a question for Scott, I hope you'll just come up to the front here of the stage. We've got a microphone here. Just give us your name and ask your question, and Scott will be there with the answer. Scott, we're going to start with some kind of sad news. The emerald ash borer has now been found in Wisconsin.
Well, there's been a lot of surveillance going on for quite a while now, and I think everyone feared that sooner or later, if you keep looking, you'll find it. And apparently, while I was up north the last few days, it was announced that it had been discovered in Ozaukee County, just north of where we are today. And that's not a good thing. Anytime these detrimental invasive species find their way into the state, usually there are consequences that aren't so good. How fast it will spread and ultimately what it'll certainly have an effect on ash trees, but what that will mean for wildlife or the environment in general remains to be seen. And maybe there's some way they can contain it, but it's not good news that it was discovered.
No, it certainly isn't. Well, we've got lots that we can talk about. One of the things, the permit deadline for turkey was this past weekend.
For folks interested in hunting this fall, there was a major permit deadline last Friday on August 1st for fall turkey permits and for goose hunting in the Horicon and a couple of other zones. The good news is, if you miss that deadline, and people always do inadvertently, surplus permits will go on sale. I think for turkeys, it's early in September, around the 6th, and there's still plenty of goose hunting opportunity in the exterior zone, which covers the vast majority of the state. So all is not lost as we approach fall.
What about the hunting seasons? We've got lots of hunting seasons that will be coming up in, I'd say, about a month, isn't it?
Just about a month. I think the first seasons open up mid-September with archery deer and then grouse and squirrels and a few other things. So it's not that far away. It's time for the hunters to be out seeking permission to hunt on private lands and doing their scouting and their prep work and be ready. This is great for me. Once we pass the point that the daily high temperature starts to decline, that becomes a good time of year for me.
I know exactly what you mean. But we have some callers online, and I think we can take a call. Mike in Coon Valley is up. Mike, you have a question? Hi.
Yeah, I do. Actually, I just thought of a second one, too, unrelated. But my first question has to do with snakes.
Mike there in Coon Valley. Mike, you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, there we go.
Okay,
there we go.
My first question has to do with the anatomy of a snake. We were traveling out east, and I came down. I was on a mountain road, and I came around a corner, and there was a fairly large snake, about probably 4 feet long. And I ran over, I had no, you know, I couldn't miss it, but I had ran over the, like, the back quarter of it with a set of tires. What are the chances of that snake surviving something like that?
Well, chances are that did some serious damage to the snake, but if the tire went over the snake from the cloaca or the vent, as it might be called, back to the tail, there's not as much going on there as there is forward of the vent, where all the internal organs are. So there's a chance. I mean, many reptiles, lizards, for example, and salamanders, can lose their tail completely, and some lizards can grow a new tail. So there's at least a chance. If it soothes your conscience a little bit, we'll assume that the tire mark was far enough back that the snake may be a little flat in that area, but maybe getting along okay.
All right, thanks, buddy.
Unrelated now. We're out there actually for my daughter's graduation from boot camp. And she's talked about going deer hunting, but she's never done hunter's education. Will she still have to do hunter's education, even though she's qualified with the rifle with the Army and everything?
No, that's a question that you should probably direct to a local DNR warden. It seems to me that military folks have an opportunity to get, especially, so she's a resident of Wisconsin, but active military. Is that right?
Yes.
It seems to me that when a military member comes back to Wisconsin and they're on active duty, they qualify for a hunting license. Now, whether that waives the hunter ed requirement or not, I don't know, but I have a suspicion that it might. So that's a simple question to address to any DNR service center or warden, and they can give you the final answer on that.
And maybe somebody, maybe a DNR rep is listening in today and can call us and let us know that. But otherwise, Mike, just check with your local DNR rep.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take another call. Doug, I believe, is online from Saner. And Doug, we'll give you an opportunity now. Hi, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, great program. My question is, I was just made aware that they changed the deadline application date for the bobcat harvest tag.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know now, because I missed it, am I going to lose my preference point going into next year? It just seems like they move these application deadline dates around so much that if a guy don't, you know, he just inadvertently all of a sudden, they moved it 10 days sooner. So now here I am, was going to go out tonight and purchase my bobcat tag application, and now I can't because they moved the deadline date again. And
I'm sympathetic,
if
Doug.
I'm going to lose my preference points that I've already built up. I think it's just BS.
Well, I'm sympathetic. I too thought, you know, for years, I think the deadline for the turkey and goose permits has been August 10th, and all of a sudden, wait, well, August 1st, what happened here? But that's the way it was, and I'm fearful that if you miss the deadline, you may be out of luck. But again, like with the previous caller, that's a technical point on the regulations that if you call a service center from where you are in Saner, the DNR office on Highway J in Woodruff, either stop in there or give them a call and explain what happened. And at the least, I think you may not be able to get a permit for this year, but in terms of the preference points, I would think that there might be hope for that. Yeah. But I just don't know.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today as we broadcast from the Wisconsin State Fair. You may be hearing in the background some polka music, which is coming from the beer tent, which is right next door to us here. But so that's the musical background for today, and I expect that'll probably be going on the rest of the day, Scott.
It's a very festive situation, Larry. It's great.
It is a very festive situation. And again, if you want to join us, the number to call 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Scott, I don't know about you, but lots of people have been complaining to me about critters in the garden. We have on the bug side, we should have Phil Pelletieri here for a little backup on this one, but our cherry tree that we planted this year went out yesterday, and it was, unfortunately, it's planted near some grapevines,
mm-hmm.
and grape leaves apparently are very much favored by Japanese beetles.
Uh-oh.
And the Japanese beetles are after our cherry tree leaves in force.
Well, keep them there in town, Larry, because I've yet to see a Japanese beetle out in the countryside where I live, and I hope it stays that way. But
well, they've taken care of our roses and that.
It is a tough time in the garden, but the good news is that now that things are coming in and everybody's kind of up to their ears in zucchini and tomatoes finally coming in,
right?
That generally the animal problems are, people tend to tolerate them a little bit more. So it's not quite as problematic. But the bottom line still is, you just can't beat a good fence around the garden. If you fence, good fences make good neighbors, makes for good neighbors with wildlife as well.
And again, the number of comments, we've got Doug here, and we talked with Doug from Sainert. So we'll take our next call in just a second. By the way, for those of you listening in right in front of me here, if you have a question for Scott, feel free to come up to the microphone and ask your question. I see some people who may or may not know much about wildlife right in front of us here, Scott. But
the may not, I think, was the answer there.
Well, listen, turtles are hatching and are out and about now.
It's that time of year. Everything was a little bit late this year because of the flooding and the cool temperatures. But typically from now until about mid-September into October, the turtles are hatching, and people will start to find little nickel, dime, quarter-sized turtles out on the landscape. And best thing you can do for them there is give them a little break, help them to the nearest water, and send them on their way. And if you're lucky enough to find the nest, if you sit there, find a little hole they're digging out of, you may pick up 5, 10, dozen, 15, or 20 of them, depending on the species of turtle. Then you can take them all down to the water. It's a long trip when your legs are about a quarter of an inch long and you've got to get through the grass.
It is a long trip. And how many turtles do we have here in species in Wisconsin?
There are about a dozen species. In fact, one of the things we have at our display here at UW Day here at the fair is a display of turtle shells so people can practice their identification skills. And some are very common, some are very rare. Most people who come by seem to be able to identify the snapping turtle and the painted turtle. But when they get to the blandings and the box turtle and the wood turtle, that separates the turtle experts from the novices.
And you've got some pelts and a lot of other things to see at the fair.
There's lots of neat things here. This is a great idea to have the university represented here.
I agree with you 100%. Well, we have more callers online. I want to get to John in Chippewa Falls, I believe, next. Let's go to John. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I have a question. I was on the Bearskin bike trail up by Hazelhurst, and I was it was about 8 in the morning around July 4th, and can you hear me?
Yes,
go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, I saw two snakes that were between 3.5 to 4 feet. They were jet black, very shiny in the sunlight, hardly any markings. And I looked up on the DNR reptile site, et cetera. Large, fast snakes. And I think they were there maybe looking for turtle eggs. Anyway, they were right next to that area where there were turtle eggs or had been deposited. And I'm just wondering if you got any ideas. They had kind of a little yellow on their eyes, very, very large black snakes.
Well, the only really black snake that we have in the state is a pilot black snake found in the southwestern part of the state. But in that area along the trail and along the water, an old large specimen of a northern water snake, a banded water snake, which would have distinctive markings on it if it's younger, might get to the point where it was dark enough to describe it as black. There aren't that many large snakes up in that countryside.
No.
Snakes in the North Woods are pretty uncommon. It had no stripes or markings on it of any kind that you could see.
Unfortunately, I went back to get my camera, obviously, and they were gone. It was early in the morning, and they were very large snakes, and it was right next to a really my little Bearskin swampy area, and I could not see any markings whatsoever on them, but they were very shiny black, and nothing fits that in the book besides what you mentioned, a snake in the southwest. What did you say the name of that snake was?
Pilot black snake or black rat snake is another name for it, and they are... They are black as mature specimens, but that would be a very unusual spot for one. I think if you had the book and looked at the guide, you'd see that they're primarily in the southwestern corner of the state.
That's why I was totally into that.
But as you get to older, larger specimens of some snakes that are more common, like the water snakes, they do get darker in coloration, and the markings that are typical of a younger specimen kind of fade away. So that's the only explanation I can give you. There are occasionally melanistic forms of some of the common snakes. In other words, it's something, even a garter snake, for example, can occur in a melanistic phase or black phase.
That's true.
Kind of like the black-gray squirrels that we see. Perfectly normal other than the black color phase. So it's possible that it may have been something more common, like even a fox snake, which is probably more, I've never heard of a melanistic fox snake, but that's a possibility. So the mystery without a photograph, the mystery is going to remain unsolved.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're broadcasting today from the Wisconsin State Fair. Larry Mueller here. Producer today is, as always, Jim Packard. Our on-air producer, Brittany DeAnda today. Marv Nahn has lended his engineering expertise and set things up for us. Our board operator, Dave Potratz. ROC operator, Aubrey Ralph. So thanks to everybody for helping make this event a great one here at UW Days at Wisconsin State Fair. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Broadcasting from the Wisconsin State Fair, I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. If you'd like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or at Madison at 263-1890. If you're in the audience today and have a question, feel free to come on up to the microphone. It was right in front of us here, and you can give us your name and ask a question, and we'll be glad to do that. Matter of fact, we have somebody coming up right now, so we'll...
I just want to know, do sandhill cranes sit in trees, or are they specifically in the ground?
All right,
Scott. Because we saw some in the fields, hundreds of them when we were up north, but at night they're gone. So they don't want to be in the field because they could get caught.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if they do go in the tree. I know the blue heron does.
Yes. If you see a large crane-like bird in a tree, it's far more likely to be a blue heron, which actually nest in the trees as well, as do most of the herons. But the cranes stay on the ground.
They
move back to the swamps and wetlands and whatnot. Right. Okay, and they're in the fields to feed.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for that question. And again, anybody in the audience has a question for Scott, feel free to come forward. In the meantime, we'll go to Karen in Richland Center.
Hi, good
Karen,
morning,
are you
Larry,
there?
Scott.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, I can barely hear you, but I guess I just have a question. My dog made a gift of two very young rabbits to me over the last couple of days. Their eyes are barely open, but they're just precious and darling, and I'd like to do what I can to keep them alive, and I'm wondering what I can feed them. I've been using an eyedropper with some water and some kitten milk replacer. Am I doing the right thing?
Well, I think that's a reasonable start. People are often very sympathetic toward young animals like that when they're found. It's if you go too far with this and you're successful, it's sometimes kind of hard to release them back into the wild. And theoretically, they're a wild animal, which in private possession like that is a problem as well.
Illegal, isn't it, or is it?
Technically speaking, yes. But the one strategy, if you put them out, if you don't know where the nest was, simply put them outside. They're pretty well doomed. So the only other alternative is to locate in your area a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. The Rehabilitators Association has a website, which might help, and the DNR service centers usually know who the licensed rehabbers are in their area or in your area, so you could check that way. But you're on the right track with your care, but I'm not sure I recommend the approach. I understand how people can get attached to young things like that. They're cute little things, and you want to do something for them and get them back into the wild, but it might be easier to get the help of someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Jeff in Bruce, Wisconsin next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are we doing today?
Great.
Great.
My question, we got hit by horrific winds this past weekend, and in the town of Bruce, it's in Russ County, we lost hundreds of trees, and there's some willow trees. I've been wanting some willow trees, and I'm wondering, can I take some branches from some of these that have been uprooted and grow roots on them?
If you take
willows, are pretty easy.
Willows are pretty easy to root. I'll tell you a story. I found some willow sprouts that were coming up in a wetland on a friend's farm, and they were perfectly straight and 6 or 7 feet tall. I think, wow, those would be great tomato steaks. And I cut, this was many years ago, I cut them and shoved them in the ground to tie my tomatoes to, and I fairly quickly had a nice row of willow trees. And I don't remember how well the tomatoes did, but if it, the younger wood you can get, I think the better your chances are of getting them rooted. So if you can get sprouts or suckers off the tree rather than you know, really limb material off a mature part of the tree, you'll be better off. And I think you can also get something in most garden centers called rooting powder, which has a, I don't know what it is, must have a hormone or something. We need a plant scientist, Larry. But I think if you dip the sprouts in those before you put them in the ground, it will even enhance their ability to root.
Yeah, you shouldn't have any trouble at all.
You put them right in the ground. Yeah.
Just shove them
in the ground.
And keep them wet. They're going to need moisture.
All right. And let's see. Let's take some more calls here. Look, Madeline Alt is handing out cheese to us as we speak here. But let's go to Chris in Spring Green, I think, is next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have both an answer and a question regarding an earlier caller who asked about Hunter Safety Course exemption. For active military, for someone who's gone through basic training, there is an exemption in the state of Wisconsin. So
Excellent.
His daughter will not need to go through a hunter safety course to hunt. And I had a question regarding hunting woodchucks in Wisconsin. It's my understanding that there's no season on woodchucks whatsoever in Wisconsin. And I was curious as if Professor Craven knew as to why that is. They seem to be in abundance, at least in southern Wisconsin.
They are in abundance, and the reason that the woodchuck is a protected species dates back to the 40s or 50s when they were considerably less abundant and highly valued because of the digging and whatnot that they did, which was deemed beneficial for rabbits and salamanders and snakes and other things that would use those burrows. So they were granted full protection, and that protection has stuck now, even though woodchucks or groundhogs have become far more abundant, far more problematic for many people. And the provision that's been added in recognition of those problems is that while they are protected on your own land, if you're the owner or occupant of a piece of property, you may hunt or control woodchucks throughout the year. So you can hunt them if you want to hunt woodchucks or control them. You can do so on your own property, but otherwise they are protected. And it dates back to the value that was attached to them. I've heard various rumblings over the last 10 or 15 years that, hey, maybe it's time to repeal the protection on woodchucks, but so far that hasn't happened.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Cher in Thelma next. Hi, Cher.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a creek and kind of a small wetland down below us, below our house. And in the spring, we just hear hundreds of frogs. Now, this time of the year, if we go down there, we can hear bullfrogs, but we don't hear any other frogs. Are they still there? Why don't we hear them anymore?
Well, there are about a dozen frogs, and there's a very nice standard sequence at which these different species enter the singing chorus and leave the singing chorus over the course of the year from very early spring to midsummer. The last two to sing are the ones you're hearing now, which are bullfrogs and green frogs. The earliest ones are first the wood frog, and then the spring peepers and the chorus frogs, and then toads and leopard frogs. But they only sing while the males are at the breeding ponds. Once the breeding effort is expended for that particular species, they leave. And some of them, like the tree frogs and peepers and whatnot, move back up into the woodlands, leave the breeding ponds entirely, and clam up for the rest of the year. And they won't sing again until next spring. And then they're replaced by one or two other species. So there are pretty much always frogs singing from early spring to now, but it's a sequence of different species. So those animals are still around. They may not be right in the creek or the pond per se, but they're still in the area, but they've just quit singing.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have some open lines. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. And anybody in the audience who has a question for Scott, just come on up to the microphone right in front of the stage and you can ask your question. And Rebecca in Platteville is up next.
Hello.
Hi, Rebecca.
Okay, my question is this. Many different kinds of birds, like wrens, will have more than one bunch of babies. Set up housekeeping, the babies will fledge, and then they do again. My question is, do those first ones, do they ever become mature enough to actually set up housekeeping themselves that first season? The reason why I ask is that I had all my boxes, and I have 11 boxes, all have wrens in them, and different wrens, and all of a sudden, I had more wrens wanting home. So I put up some more, and those got taken too, and the other ones didn't get emptied. So I wanted to know if those were babies number one.
Well, it's possible
they do that the first year, or they stay teenagers and just watch and learn.
No, they need at least a year to mature, and some birds and animals take multiple years. But the notion of multiple broods depends a little bit on the species. And it depends a little bit on the nesting season. Some birds won't have a second clutch unless they lose the first one before the birds actually fledge. Some birds have such a long developmental period that there's no time for a second brood. So I think if you've got more wrens moving into the area, it's either displaced nesters from another area, you know, maybe related to some of the water issues we've had, or potentially just non-breeding wrens that are looking for a box as a roost site or for some other purpose. But they're not this year's young that are looking to nest on their own.
A regular oasis of wrens there.
That's a lot of wrens.
That's a
lot of wrens.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And Patty is up next in Oregon. Patty, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question about whippoorwills. I have been in the Red Granite area this summer and Black River Falls and just came home from a week in Lake Tomahawk, and I have been hearing whippoorwills everywhere I go this summer, and I don't recall hearing them much in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 years. I'm wondering if this is just an extraordinary year for them or what the deal is.
Well, whippoorwills seemed to be quite common when I moved to Wisconsin back in the 70s, and in fact, people used to occasionally complain if you had a whippoorwill sitting on a tree limb outside your bedroom window at night. It could be very, very disturbing. They're incredibly loud. But people do like to hear them in the evening as a sound of the night. And they've been very uncommon for the past 10 or 15 years. Yeah. It was a rarity to hear one. I've not heard whether there's been a bit of a population resurgence. But again, the possibility, too, is given the weird cool weather we've had and the wet weather, that, again, birds may have been displaced from other areas and all of a sudden become more common here. For example, just as another bird species, some of our ducks that ran into very dry conditions on the Dakota prairies and so forth actually moved much further north into northern Canada to nest this year. So areas that generally don't see many ducks have seen a tremendous nesting population. So those species are capable, and especially with birds that can cover long distances in short periods, of moving around the landscape. So what we need to hope for, or hope that is happening, that it reflects a population increase or a trend upward for whippoorwills, and I think most bird watchers and bird fanciers would be pleased by that, rather than just some birds moving in from elsewhere.
Yeah, you hope they're here to stay.
So 1 year doesn't make a trend. We'll see what happens next year and the year after, and maybe we do see a trend here.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. Let's go to David in Milwaukee next. David, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was fishing in the marsh, and I heard this drumming noise. It almost sounded like a ping. Do you have any idea what that is?
Where were you fishing?
It's over by the Wolf River area.
And this was a drumming sound.
Yeah, it was just a single ping, you know, a couple of animals talking to each other back and forth. You have any idea?
Well, let's see. What makes a single note? No chance that it was some type of frog call. Not likely.
We're just speculating here.
Not likely a frog call. So it seemed to be birds that were up in a tree, for example, or something like that?
No trees around. They were in the water.
They were in the water?
Yeah. It's in tall grass.
That's a good one. I'm thinking that it may have been, if it wasn't a frog, probably not any mammal, but there are certainly some different birds, some of the rails and so forth, that make a single sharp note. Yeah. And may have been communicating with each other. So I'm thinking if you got one of the bird tapes of marsh birds or something, you might hear something that struck a chord. But without a little better recording or something else to go on, we're pretty much lost here trying to help you out.
What did it sound like? Can you imitate it?
What's that?
What did it sound like? Can you imitate it?
I can't. It was like I don't know. It's like a drum, and then on end it kind of pings, you know? Kind of high-pitched towards the end of the sound.
It could be froggish.
Sorry, I think we're not going to be able to help you out on that one.
Sorry, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Let's take another call. Julie in Ogdensburg, you are next. Hi, Julie.
Hey. My question is about I'm raising little chickens, and I live in Ogdensburg in the woods. But I was thinking, couldn't I hatch a couple peacock eggs and have them marching around the yard, too? They won't mess with the chickens. Won't they hang with chickens? What do you think?
Well, it's fairly common for folks to have peacocks around. They tend to be excellent watch birds. They are do you live near anybody? Do you have near close neighbors? That's probably a good thing, because most people, they are very, very noisy. I ran into one in the road while we were driving back to our cabin a week or two ago up in northern Wisconsin. It was a monster. The tail must have been 8 feet long behind it. And that bird, it knew it was on its own turf by the barn, and it just walked across the road and then turned around and cut loose with just a din. People keep them around livestock. They actually are pretty helpful in terms of letting the owner know that something's amiss on the landscape.
And they eat a lot of insects.
And they're certainly pretty, so if you can stand the noise, it's worth a try.
Thanks for calling. And Pat is up next, I believe. Pat, hello.
Hello. I have a problem. Hi. We have hundreds of little toads the size of nickels. They don't get any bigger. They've been around all summer, and we've had the property for 35 years, never experienced anything like this. I'm wondering if they could be poisonous, because our dog got really sick, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, toads in general have a couple little glands on their back, right behind their eyes on the top of their head, which have a very noxious fluid in it. As a result, most things won't eat a toad. And if you find where a raccoon has tried to eat a toad, usually just the head and the back of the neck is left, and the raccoon ate the rest of it. So if the dog decided, all these little toads look like tasty snacks, then it may very well have gotten sick from them. But what happened is you must have a little pond or wetland around somewhere.
Well, we're on a lake.
Okay, well, this, for some amphibians, this was a great year in terms of reproductive success. And toads are very early breeders, and once those little toadlets emerge and the tadpoles change into little tiny toads the size of your fingernail, there can be, we've had reports over the years of people who called it an invasion. The sidewalks were covered, they were literally everywhere.
They will
eventually disperse, and a lot of them, when they're in those numbers, a lot of them won't make it through the winter. And things may return to normal next spring. But what you're just seeing is an unusually successful emergence of toads. A female toad lays thousands of eggs in long strings. And if conditions are right and all of those hatch and the tadpoles do well, the pond doesn't dry up, and all of a sudden they all turn into toads, they can be everywhere. So be patient and they'll disappear. And they really won't, other than simply being around, they really won't cause you any annoyance, and they're eating a lot of bugs that you might not want to have around.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And on to another caller. Aaron in Ashland County is up next. Hi, Aaron.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, thanks for calling.
I had a question. We are traveling through Ashland County. Actually, on our way up to Hayward, we are considering going blueberry picking. But in route, we passed through several towns that hope that Ashland County, in fact, their cities are the home of extremely high black bear populations. We were curious what would be the best plan of action for a person to take if they were to encounter a black bear or in a group.
Yeah. Well, if you're berry picking and you run into a bear, chances are the bear's there for the same reason, and they're not particularly interested in you, and just as likely to be, although they might be a little perturbed about the encroachment on their berry picking, the best thing to do when you encounter one is simply stand up and back away and remain as large as you can be and slowly leave the area, and the bear's not going to be hopefully not interested in you.
Chances are the bear's going to be gone.
Chances are all you're going to hear is the bear going in the other direction. If the bear, which with much better sense of smell and so forth than you have, is going to be gone before that ever becomes a confrontation. But there are lots of people picking low bush blueberries up there. They were out pretty well over the weekend, and generally that's not a time of the year when we hear much about bear encounters. Certainly the bears are out there, and the bear population, as you may have heard, there's a speculation that it's quite a bit higher than we may have thought it was for the last few decades. We just don't hear much about human-bear encounters during the berry picking.
All right. Does that help you out?
The Forest
Service also has a nice little brochure called Living with Black Bears, and if you go online and Google black bear encounters, there are several organizations around the country that put out little fact sheets that will help you know what to do in just about any circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. We have open lines to get you on pretty quickly here. 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And if anybody in our audience has a question for Scott, feel free to come on up to the microphone and ask your question. We'd love to have you come up and ask that question. Scott, there's been some tests of several Wisconsin waters that show that some good results in terms of the spread of a VHS disease, fish disease.
Viral hemorrhagic septicemia, I think that is.
Yeah.
The bad news yesterday was the discovery of emerald ash borer. The good news released a few days ago was that the testing protocol for VHS has not turned it up in any wide distribution in Wisconsin waters. So apparently we can attribute not only the surveillance but all of the regulations that went into effect very quickly when the threat was realized, dealing with movement of minnows and bait and so forth. And, we can only hope that that's helped. So we don't want VHS. We're dealing with CWD.
No.
We don't want VHS.
That's good news. And we have a question from the audience, sir. What's your name?
Rick Ferencroup from Neenah, Wisconsin.
Hi, Rick.
Just a quick question. It's nice to see you guys. I hear you all the time. It's nice to see you.
It's nice to see our callers.
And maybe there's been discussion about this previously. I apologize if I make you repeat something. But there's a plethora of big pelicans that we see in the northern Winnebago lake pools.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, has there been any discussion about that? Is this a good thing? Are they eating us alive? What's going on? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, the question deals with the resurgence of white pelican populations, which got their toehold back in Wisconsin 10-15 years ago, primarily with a colony in Lower Green Bay, around just south of Longtail Point. And they've been doing well there. There's a really good, thriving population there. But over the last few years, they've also spilled out into the Winnebago system and probably will into other areas as well. From a bird watcher's standpoint, a white pelican is a really big, really spectacular bird. And they're kind of neat to see. When we were up there working on cormorants, the pelicans would be flying over, just over our heads, and it was like a squadron of bombers going by. The issue, of course, they are spectacular, but they eat fish. And generally, any birds that eat fish sometimes get into conflict with people who catch and eat fish. And so the concerns over cormorants that have kind of fizzled or waned a little bit in the last couple of years because the perch population's made a resurgence as well, You know, maybe at some point people will be concerned over pelicans, but at least in the numbers we see now, doesn't seem to be a big issue. Whether it will be sometime, who knows?
All right. Great question. Thank you very much. We'll take some more calls. Jane in Plymouth is up next. Hi, Jane. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. Last night, we live in the woods near a marsh, and last night on the deck was a black mink. My son-in-law was chopping wood last spring, and he saw it under the deck, and we thought it had disappeared. We also have a dog that goes out in the backwoods. Is this a problem, and are they mean or dangerous?
Okay, will the dog and the mink get into it, Scott?
Well, mink is a member of the weasel family, and weasels are known for being pretty quick and pretty aggressive and can take care of themselves. I would think that is it a big dog?
No, it's a Shih Tzu.
Now, you know, there might be a confrontation and a little barking and snarling, but I'm not sure that they'd really get together and mix it up. And the mink, I'm surprised the mink's actually taken up residence there or visiting there, unless there's something out there that it's interested in. Are you leaving? Do you feed the dog outside, for example?
No, we don't. Okay. But well, about 5 years ago, there was a mink ranch about a mile away, and someone let all of the mink go.
Okay,
and so
well,
I think that's probably where
that
it came
explains,
from.
That explains the black one, because the typical normal wild color is a rich chocolate brown or the white blaze on the throat, but black ones are fairly frequently, along with many other colors, raised in captivity. So that one's probably either a survivor or an ancestor of one of the escapees from the mink farm. And I don't think you have a whole lot to worry about.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And John in Cross Plains is up next. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions, if I can. Young turtles, the hatchlings that sometimes hatch some distance from the water, is there an orientation based on a musk or pheromone down that the female would secrete, or are they just attracted toward the water because they seem very, very directional?
They do seem directional, and it seems to be some sense that we don't understand very well in terms of knowing which way to go. But the notion that it's anything left behind by the female who may have dug that nest at least 2 to 3 months previously, or in some cases the hatchlings will even overwinter in the nest, the chances there's anything left behind and a specific trail that they follow is pretty remote. So it seems to be some sensory ability to know, hey, the water's in this general direction. And it may have something to do with slope or topography or just some sense of the water. But they seem to make it, at least enough for survival of the species.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, broadcasting from the State Fair on UW Day here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.